Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, going left on energy. And Richard, we take this as our topic today because you're seeing many different permutations of the leftward drift from Democrats on energy issues. And let's start with the instance that inspired your column at Defining Ideas this week. That is in New York State, where the government has banned fracking and blocked construction of new pipelines. And this has now become a pretty acute problem in New York with new construction, not even being able to get gas hookups. And there's an interesting point in your piece where you argue that if you're legitimately worried about climate change, and our listeners will know you're something of a skeptic on that point, but if you accept the premises of that argument, blocking this kind of sort of conventional energy development is precisely the wrong way to go about it. Explain why that is.
Well, what happens is this is the standard question of how we treat unintended consequences of government action. The way in which they put this thing forward, there is a stated positive of undefined magnitude, which comes from preventing the burning of fossil fuels and the shipping of fossil fuels, which facilitates the burning. But the next question is, what is going to happen when it turns out that people do not want to freeze at night, when people have production quotas that they have to get out? What's going to happen is they're going to use their next best alternative, which is legal under the law. And so when it comes to shipping, if it's not going to be done by a pipeline, which is a controlled and safe environment, people are going to start shipping natural gas by train and by rail. And it turns out these are not controlled environments, that something very bad can start to happen. They can be spills. Roads and trains tend to go near populated areas a very large portion of the time because of the deliveries that they have to make there. And what happens is you then have to figure out, well, how much energy and waste and carbon dioxide is going to come from having trains and railroads move much more than by pipeline? What's the danger of having a serious shipwreck, which could release all sorts of other dangerous things and kill people much higher? So on the transmission side, this is a huge minus to do this. Another thing to mention is even old pipelines are inferior to new pipelines. The correct response in all of this stuff is to constantly to allow them to be replaced and upgraded in one form or another. In some senses, the sensible way in which to do that is to put the second pipe right next to the first pipe and then put the first pipe decommissioned and out of business so that you don't have any collateral consequences. That's what they tried to do with the DAPL pipeline, the one that goes from North Dakota down to Illinois. And there was just this fierce brouhaha. We can't possibly let this happen, even though the new pipeline was sunk deeper, better mechanisms, better control, better sensors, and it was a very close fight before the thing was put into circulation, where it just caused zero damage in the basically 18 to 19 months that's been in place, and allowing the shipment of crude oil, 500,000 barrels a day, once you get this thing starting to move. So you're wrong on the shipment side of this. Well, then what about the use side? Well, it turns out that natural gas, which is what they want to ship into New York City, is safer than crude oil. It's safer than heating oil. It's safer pretty much than anything except nuclear power, which is not very well welcome in New York State. So what people have to do now is to move to their second best alternative. And well, what does that mean? It means in many cases you use some form of heating oil, which has much higher levels of carbon dioxide residues. And not only carbon dioxide, which I regard as a kind of an unimportant question, heretical as that may sound, but there are other stuff that comes out of some of these things, sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, and so forth. And nobody's ever going to say, we have to have a minimum amount of nitrous oxide in the air, or otherwise plants will die. Driving that stuff down to zero is extremely important. Driving carbon dioxide down to zero would mean the end of life as we know it on the Earth. Nothing would be able to survive or to grow. So what you're doing, in effect, is you're now in the production side having more of an environmental harm than you would have anywhere else. And well, how much of this stuff you're going to use, ironically, what's going to happen is this stuff is less efficient, so you'll have to use more of the bad stuff than you did of the good stuff, unless Unless, of course, it turns out you drive the businesses out of business altogether, at which point you then have all the forms of dislocations. So if people cannot get reliable energy sources for their homes, they'll start using inferior energy sources at that particular level. So what you've done, in effect, is to create a situation where instead of trying to improve technology and have rapid substitution, you're trying to essentially force people out of the system into something else. And I want to stress this. One of the things that most people do not understand, whether you're talking about fracking or medical technology or virtually any kind of safety issues, automobiles or whatever, compared to, say, 25 years ago, all of these technologies are basically reduced the associated risk by 75%. So new absolutely trumps old in these kinds of areas. And if you don't allow the new to come on, somebody's going to try to patch up the old. And so when you start looking at the environmental stuff, these patchwork plants are vastly inferior to the plants that could be put into their place. And this is the odd logic. You put the new plant into place, it takes 100 units of pollution, and you lower it down to 10 units of pollution. But somebody comes along and said, if you use the best available technology, whatever that turns out to be, you could lower it from 100 to 2. So what happens is we're willing to give up the 90 gain because somebody's not willing to take the enormous cost it takes to lower it by another 8 units. So best available technology becomes a barrier to entry of sensible technology, forces so much money to be spent in one area that it becomes very difficult to modernize a plant or a company in another area. So the whole standards, which essentially ignore the marginal improvements which are built into the environmental laws, are an open sore in the American system. And what we have to do is to change it. You get yourself a big improvement, we can save something as simple as this. If you knock out 5 units of carbon dioxide, for every one that you produce, we'll let you build this new plant, no questions asked. That permitting process will take approximately 10 minutes because all you have to do is assemble the data. That's how great the improvements are.
Richard, when we're talking about states that have taken extreme positions on these issues, the one we're always going to be talking about alongside New York is California. And we've witnessed,
God help us,
this incredible scene in California the last few weeks with mass power outages to stave off the danger of wildfires. You've had literally millions of people going without electricity. And this is not unrelated to these questions about energy policy. Explain the connection and how a state like California, which we tend to think of as a bastion of innovation, could find itself in these kinds of circumstances.
Well, it has many innovative firms, and it has, at this point, probably the dumbest collection of individuals in high public places in the history of mankind. That's an exaggeration, but I want people to understand this is not a close case. And so what happens is California basically reads the return, and it assumes that an ideal system of a solar energy or wind energy, particular solar energy, is preferable to the imperfect system that we have. The correct thing to do with traditional systems is to upgrade them. So instead of having lousy old lines that sag, which are around shrubs, what you do is you get rid of the shrubbery, and what you do is you upgrade the pipes. Some of them, if they're dangerous, you put them underground. But what they do is they say, no, what's really important is to subsidize solar energy. Now, solar energy essentially has the following very undesirable tactic, which is when you have it most, you need it least. When you have it least, you need it most. That is, when you're trying to use it for heating and the sun shines, you get all this stuff, but it's already 90 degrees, you don't need it. So what the system does is it requires the PG&E to buy this stuff back. Now, I would regard this as confiscatory because what you're forcing a company to do is to essentially spend good money in order to get bad product. But under California and even under federal law, the level of discretion that we give for people to reorganize the so-called environmental issues in this country is so broad that these challenges, at least to date, have never made any headway. So they're doing all of this stuff. In the meantime, what they're doing is they are basically building a funeral pyre on which the state will burn. So they refuse to clean off the lousy stuff on public lands. And what you do is you get a lot of dead wood, you get a lot of little straggly twigs and so forth. And if you think about the way in which you start a fire in your own fireplace, you start on the little twigs, then it goes to the dry woods, and then you burn logs. Well, it turns out those logs are forests. And only fires only begin on public lands. They don't begin on the Koch brothers lands through Georgia Pacific and other companies, because those guys actually know how to manage their property. But the environmentalists are obsessed with this notion of naturalness of one kind or another. And it turns out any human intervention, whether positive or negative, in terms of its consequences, is to be frowned upon. So what they do is it's just a perfect storm. They don't repair the pipelines, whether the wires are overhead. They don't clean the brush away. And then they allow people to build nearer and nearer to these kinds of activities, so they get swept up in this. And what happens is you see these fireballs start to grow and grow and go. And so in the last round, the prayer was, and I think it was answered, well, this fire won't jump 101. So it turns out the only way we managed to save ourselves from the ravages of neighbors is to look at these highways that these folks don't want anybody to buy, to build. But they are essentially what the fire bridge is. And it's just taking place. And so you then start to see, well, is there going to be any kind of change in California? And there's, I recommend to every reader, a wonderful article in the Wall Street Journal by Alyssa Finley, in which she says it's the company that can shoot straight, that manages to create concrete chaos out of this, is not only prevented from doing sensible things, but what they really have to report on is the number of LGBTQ employees that they have within their ranks, so as to make sure that they get the highest rating on social responsibility. Now, I don't care very much about social responsibility, but even those people who do care about social responsibility, so-called, have to ask themselves, do you really like to have another 5% of gay workers in these particular companies, or would you rather do without these huge fires and millions upon millions of people being dislocated? And in California, they don't believe there's a trade-off. But the energy stuff and the environmental stuff is everywhere. So I just read a recent piece, and I don't know if it's true, but I suspect it is. When they built the MAX, they were told they had to build it to make it environmentally sensitive. And when you want to make it environmentally sensitive, what they did is they shifted the engine and the wing configuration to reduce drag or some such thing. But it turns out that's not the efficient way to fly a plane. And so what you then have to do is to adjust the various control mechanisms to correct for the introductions that of the distortions you put in there. And generally speaking, when you're playing catch-up, we change one system, we have to change another system. It's very hard to get the second set of changes correct. And then what you do is you get something like this. So to me, when I think about this environment, stuff. It's not just the pipelines. It's not just the big stuff. I want to ask how it is that this concern with carbon dioxide influences thousands upon thousands of mid-level decisions. Because you ask, do I think that this is very serious? The answer that I give in all of these cases is as follows. Carbon dioxide may, all other things being equal, have some modest positive attempts on temperature. But all other things aren't equal. And the most important thing that isn't equal is photosynthesis, which essentially gives more greenery, stabilizes temperatures, and that is governed by carbon dioxide in a much more powerful and direct way. So the net effect of carbon dioxide, as far as I can tell, is actually positive. It is certainly clear that you cannot use changes in carbon dioxide to change climate patterns or temperature patterns. You just look at any graph and you'll see that the temperatures tend to go up and down, sometimes in cycles, sometimes in zigs and zags. Well, what's happening to carbon dioxide over this entire period is it's going slowly but inexorably upward. You can't use this as the sole explanation for the temperature situation because you have to find some force which explains why it is that temperatures start to go down when carbon dioxide goes up. Most recently, between 2016 and 2018, where the decline in temperatures worldwide was 0.56 degrees centigrade or 1 degree Fahrenheit downward during this period. Well, something has to explain it. There are lots of given explanations relating to sun alignment, to volcanoes, Lord knows what. But anybody who simply assumes that the only independent variable that matters for temperature is carbon dioxide, let alone carbon dioxide made by human beings, simply has a grotesquely simplified view of the world. And that's exactly the way in which these political debates are taking place. Carbon dioxide is the cause of global warming. Could mean if this changes one unit, the other thing changes one movement. Or it could mean there may be a positive and or negative effect depending on how it implements itself in the various systems. And the two definitions give you completely different results. And we're using the wrong definition, getting the wrong result. And the folks in the California legislature are pushing PG&E to make these changes. For all I know, the company may be willing to do it, but everybody in that state is paying a ghastly price under these circumstances. and the effect on global warming from all this pollution going into the sky, not just carbon dioxide, but everything else, it's an unparalleled tragedy.
We've been talking about state issues. Let me close this out by having you discuss the way this is playing out on the federal side, especially in the context of this campaign right now, because a common theme on the left is that the whole critique of shifting our energy economy that is made from the right is based on what the left would characterize as a false dichotomy, this idea that you'll sacrifice economic growth if you get serious about green policies. And the most explicit example of this, Bernie Sanders claims that a Green New Deal will create 20 million jobs, and that even though it'll cost $16 trillion by his estimate, it will pay for itself because the economic dislocations from climate change will, again, by his estimates, be more than double that. How should we parse claims like that about the economics of switching our energy economy?
Well, I mean, what you really have to ask is what on earth gives him the ability to figure out what the net benefits are? It is certainly extremely easy to figure out what some of these costs are going to be. But if you start going back and look at the various projections that were made 20 and 30 years ago, the one guy who sticks out as erroneous like a sore thumb is Al Gore. And so, for example, in 1996, he predicted that the increase in the size of the oceans, the height of the oceans, would be 40 inches. And it's sort of like about 1.5 to 2 inches, depending on where you look at how you measure. So he's off by a factor of 20. If you go back and you read An Inconvenient Truth, the only inconvenient falsehood is that everything that that book predicted about 2016 in 2006 is completely wrong. So you have to have a much more clearly nuanced situation. What they basically seem to do is to assume that every one of these temperature changes is going to produce massive dislocations, sea rise. Very, very high. It's wrong. They're going to choose that it's going to have adverse effects upon agricultural infrastructure. That's wrong. One of the things we know about agriculture, just one very nice study that I saw, is that somebody looked at the ability to grow grain from northern Mississippi to southern Minnesota and tried to figure out when you have a change in temperature of 20 degrees from one place to the other by virtue of their location, what does it do to crop yield? And the answer is virtually nothing. Why is that? Because people just don't plant seed. They plant seed which is calibrated to the soil, to the air temperatures, to the water temperatures of different locations. And so what they're able to do is to make these kinds of adjustments. The kinds of proposals that Mr. Sanders seems to think is that when there's a change in nature, everything that is done by human beings has to be completely inert. So if you're trying to figure out what these forward projections are going to start to look like, you get some kind of information about that. Do we see any real panic with respect to land prices being bid up one way or another? Do we see people starting to hoard agricultural goods? And the answer is, of course, we see nothing whatsoever of anything of that particular sort. There you go to New York State, and what they're doing, if you listen to Bill de Blasio, is he says, well, all the city's going to be underwater. Well, then the question is, when you issue your bonds, what do you say? Do you say, you are issuing bonds to a city which is about to be underwater, we won't be able to repay you? No. What they say in the bond offerings is exactly the opposite, and it's correct. We have no particular reason to think that there's going to be any serious changes of what's going on. So let me see if I could then put this in a slightly different fashion to make the point that I made before about all these projections. The projections always assume that the climate model is essentially unilateral. It's just moving in one direction, monotonic, up, 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 up. No matter what you look at, temperature changes, hurricane frequencies, you name it, it's always cyclical. It increases, it decreases. If you only report the upside of the sine curve and ignore the downside of the sine curve, you're going to be in a state of abstract frenzy. It's just not true. And so this entire cottage industry of trying to tell you what the social cost of carbon is essentially starting to tell you what's going to happen when we ruin the economy by keeping along this current path. There is no sign of that whatsoever. What we can be perfectly sure of is that if you try to put into place the massive dislocations that this man wants, you will create the very conditions you're trying to avoid. Look, this point has been with no claim of originality under these circumstances. You can't store solar energy. You can't store wind energy. You can store fossil fuels. The physical limitations are that you have to create six times the amount of inputs from whatever it is you want to do with wind and solar to get what you can get out of 1 pound of inputs when it comes to working with fossil fuels. It is completely dominant. This country, this world is still 80% run by fossil fuels. It probably should be higher because if you take out the huge subsidies that prop up wind and solar energies, if those include, by the way, not only the cash subsidies, but oh, we ignore the nuisances, oh, we ignore the dead birds, oh, we ignore the fact that you're going to destroy the land over which you're putting all these solar panels. If you take all that stuff out, there is no comparison whatsoever. As I mentioned earlier, and I'll just close on this note, every single form of energy production that we have now is basically 25% of the cost for any unit output that we had 25 years ago. You just keep on that technological path and you will solve this problem. This is the worst kind of anxiety mongering. It's hard to imagine anybody as ignorant as Bernie Sanders running for public office, but unfortunately on that issue, he has a lot of competition.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.